Hello and welcome to Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a very, very special episode because for only the second time in the 100 or so episodes or whatever it is that we've done on this show, Josh and I are recording in the same place. Very exciting, Josh. I can actually say, how are you to your face?
I'm doing well. For those that want to know more about my life, I've moved back to Melbourne as a specialist.
Yes, he's finally seen the light and decided that Melbourne's better than Sydney.
Yes, well, the weather has been wonderful the last month, so I've got to say I'm waiting for the penny to drop, so to speak. But Michael, let's just get into it. I'm just going to get lost in your eyes and we're not going to edit that part out, but what are we talking about today?
Yeah, so we really hope you enjoyed Josh's grand adventure and his series of interviews with several big movers and shakers in the Dana-Farber Institute in Boston. But we're getting back to our normal operating procedure. And so we're going to talk about a conference that is probably slightly old news by the time we record this and by the time it's released, but it is relevant and interesting anyway, and that is the ASCO GU conference. We seem to do one of these pretty much every year, Josh, where we speak about this conference because I think it's sort of the first one in the calendar year, and so we always get very excited. New year, new evidence.
Yeah, that's great. That was a great introduction, Michael. But the GU conference happened earlier this month, or maybe late the month before.
It was in January.
It's January, all right.
Josh has no sense of time.
I don't, or direction. But why don't we get started?
So I will
talk about the CONTACT-02 study. And the thing with all of these cancer types that we talk about is that most have first and second line treatment options. And then you're kind of off the chemotherapy land or trial land. It isn't really a sequence of treatments yet for most cancer subtypes, apart from, I'd probably say, breast is the one that has well-defined evidence for multiple lines of therapy. But the GU, of course, we're not talking about breast. We're talking about prostate, one of my favorite topics, which is, in this case, the CONTACT-02 is cabozantinib and atezolizumab, our old friend, our old immunotherapy friend, versus second novel hormonal therapy for patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer.
Yeah, interesting right off the bat because prostate cancer is famously one of the few cancers that is very immunogenically cold. And so if we can get immunotherapy into this space, it would be good.
It would be, you know, another pembrolizumab would love to make a stake in another cancer subtype. So what happens with prostate cancer? So first-line therapy, especially in the castrate-sensitive, but also historically the castrate-resistant, they use novel hormonal therapies. So what I'm talking about that, don't know if you can call them novel hormonal therapies, but abiraterone, enzalutamide, darolutamide and apalutamide are the four. Essentially, they work by stopping testosterone production within the cancer cell once it becomes resistant to Leucrin or ADT. And for those that are interested, ADT was created in 1941. And the guy who, I think it was Huggins, I've said this previously.
That's you do why love busting this
I do love out. Huggins. It's my fun fact. I tell all my patients, he got a Nobel Prize for it.
And well deserved.
Thank you. So what we know is that after novel hormonal therapy, prognosis is poor and worse with those with visceral metastases. Secondary options post, I'm going to say androgen receptor signaling inhibitors, that's the better name, which are non-targeted, include chemotherapy, or second, novel hormonal therapies. Although this is not done in Australia because there's limited evidence to support this.
And there are also PBS restrictions. You can't go on one novel anti-androgen therapy if you have progressed on the other. Otherwise, the government will come and get you.
Yeah, Michael, not just a pretty face. There is a little bit of evidence between switching between, I think it's enzalutamide and abiraterone or vice versa, but it's very limited.
Because they work in different ways, but enzalutamide, apalutamide, darolutamide, they're all sort of cousins, as it were.
Yeah, and you might be asking, what about cabozantinib? Do we care about that? Well, the thought is that cabozantinib might actually augment the immunotherapy response by creating a permissive environment. So essentially making an environment where the immunotherapy is more immunogenic. So, you know, your T cells are going to attack the cancer. There was a phase 1b COSMIC 021 study that looked at cabozantinib, which is tyrosine kinase inhibitor, plus atezolizumab post this. And there was some, you know, in combination that was clinically active and safe from a toxic perspective. So I'm going to move fast because we've already been chatting for I don't know how long. The phase 3, which is CONTACT 02, you know, ET, Michael, you can be ET, I'll be Steven Spielberg. So they reported the efficacy of this combination therapy versus second novel hormonal therapy for metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer with visceral mets post-first NHT. So the randomization, so the intervention arm, or the second novel hormonal therapy, which is either enzalutamide or abiraterone, and that was all continued until loss of clinical benefit. So they found people that had PSA progression and or soft tissue disease with measurable extrapelvic metastases, good performance status, I think, et cetera, et cetera. It's very much the standard. Primary endpoint, progression-free survival, and secondary key endpoints, objective response rate, by blinded independent clinical review. Baseline characteristics, pretty well balanced, Michael. Median age 71, which is smack bang men.
That's prostate pretty cancer. Average, yeah.
Yep. All had sort of good performance status. And I mean, realistically, we treat people with poor performance statuses in prostate cancer. PSA was high in the intervention arm, but it was 34 versus 25. I'm going to stop and just say one thing. Just because you've got a higher PSA does not actually mean you have higher volume of disease. That correlation, I don't think, has been proven. Michael, would you agree?
Yeah, I think sort of on a gross level, because some cancers will be high PSA excretors, and then you have everyone's nightmare scenario, which is the small cell differentiators, which obviously don't secrete PSA at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And so while the trend, this is what I always say, while the trend is important in assessing disease progress, the actual number generally doesn't.
Yeah, and the number that the specialist I used to work with, Anthony Joshua, the big professor, the one and only, he used to quote, I think about 10 to 15%, despite being on a novel hormonal agent, might not express PSAs. And so imaging, while not needed as commonly, is still important for people who are long-term responders. Let's dig into the results. Not the juicy part, Mike, but we're digging. We're digging for the results.
We're digging for the juiciness.
Okay. So the PFS for cabozantinib and atezolizumab was 6.3 months versus 4.2 months of the second novel hormonal therapy agent. Hazard ratio, 0.65. So here we see a 35% benefit versus what they're doing as the standard of care. In the intention to treat, it was pretty similar, and the PFS intention to treat based on kind of their criteria, their bony criteria, was very similar as well. That was all very, very good. Moving on, it was better in those with ECOG of 1, more effective in those with liver metastases. Those that have prior docetaxel was better as well. When the first novel hormonal therapy was introduced, the majority was in the castrate-resistant prostate cancer. They found the hazard ratio was 0.69 versus 0.88 in the M0 cohort and the 0.65 in the castrate-sensitive cohort. So this is an interesting little side point because we're moving towards giving the novel hormonal therapies in the sensitive stage. So we might have to reassess what this sort of looks like. And it was better in bone disease as well. So I think poorer performance status, higher visceral burden would generally indicate this combination therapy does better. Subjective response rate, not great. It was 14.4 versus 4%, but still a 10% climb on switching it. So
it's better. Mm-hmm. Like you have to say it's better, but it doesn't, just because something is better doesn't mean it's good.
No, and also
slight distinction.
And the financial burden as well, right? It's like, okay, they're both expensive drugs, so maybe this is irrelevant, but you have to kind of think. But there is your complete response in one person, so that's interesting, and partial response in 13 versus 4%, and stable disease in 59 versus 50%. So,
sorry, Josh, you might have mentioned this, but was there anything about the duration of response? Because we know that with immunotherapy, PFS frequently doesn't tell the whole story. So is there anything about duration response with the immunotherapy arm compared to the novel hormonal arm?
You always love asking me these questions, Michael. You just want to like, it's like, Josh, keep going, hurry up. Okay, so the median, I've got duration of exposure. Would that be an okay answer for you?
I will accept that. Okay, I'll allow it.
The cabozantinib was 4.2 months. The atezolizumab was 4.2 months. And the second novel hormonal agent was 3.1 months, although up to 27 months. So like, you're going to have people in this subgroup who are going to respond really, really well. And I think that's something just important to mention. Other important things to talk about, the median time to chemotherapy was not reached in either arm, but a hazard ratio of 0.56, not statistically significant, I believe. But what that means is that people live a very long time with prostate cancer.
It means our treatments are good as they are.
That's it. You know, not the best, but they're still good. Most were given at full sort of dosage, which is great. And when you look at toxicities, interesting thing, intervention arm, 40% diarrhea versus 4%. You know, TKIs cause diarrhea. Decreased appetite in 38 versus 12%. Fatigue in 27 versus 17%. Nausea in 25 versus 11%. You know, this kind of indicates it is a more toxic regimen.
And it is quite frequently difficult to tolerate for people of the frailer persuasion.
Exactly. And I'm going to say old people, just people that are older. The older you are, the more frail you become. I think that's a good generalization.
Yeah, in general.
So conclusion, overall survival is immature at present. The intervention arm of cabozantinib plus atezolizumab resulted in an improved progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.65. So it is better. We still need some ongoing work with that. There was benefit observed in most pre-specified groups. And they say safety is similar and deemed manageable. Look, it is manageable, I think, if you look at other toxicities of other drugs. The question is, if you give someone docetaxel and they last for a couple of years, it's six cycles, it's pretty manageable. You know, we can manage the diarrhea really well. Would you go with that and then wait for this for a later line therapy? Unsure. I probably wouldn't give a second novel hormonal agent either.
Yeah, no, and I did want to sort of throw another wrench in the works. I'm going to do what you should never do, children, if you're listening, don't do what I'm about to do, but I'm going to do a cross-trial comparison with with the CARD study, which is the cabazitaxel study. Now, we've been hard on cabazitaxel in the show, as one of our listeners has mentioned to us in confidence, but if we're going to do sort of a PFS dirty cross-trial comparison, so to very briefly recap, because I don't want to derail the conversation, but CARD had a similar control group in that the cabazitaxel was compared to a second novel anti-androgen therapy as it was at that time. And the PFS in the control group is similar. It's 3.7 months in the control group, and I think in this study it was about 4.2. So fairly similar. PFS for cabazitaxel was 8 months, which is better numerically than the combination of atezolizumab and cabozantinib here. Now, obviously, caveats, a big part of this approach is going to be delaying you needing chemo. But that, to me, is a bit offset by the fact that the combination is toxic in and of itself.
Good point, Michael. I think you're right. And what they should do another trial. Add cabazi. It is a cheap control arm. I think it's cheap. It's a cheap control arm if you want a control arm. It would be nice to know because these drugs are all now used first line, they're talking about. So the subsequent second line therapy should be chosen, like breast cancer should be chosen very specifically to see if it's better.
Although if we are being a devil's advocate, it is an important question and probably more important than when the CARD trial was done about cross-resistance between novel anti-androgens, given that we're burning through, as you've mentioned a couple of times, we're burning through these really good agents early now. Everyone pretty much is getting novel anti-androgens in the castration-sensitive space these days if they have any burden of disease. And so knowing whether there is anything to be gained by repeating, re-challenging, or using a different agent is probably much more relevant now than it has been in the past.
That is very wise words, Michael. But we've made contact with this topic. Why don't we move on, Michael? Tell me, give me your words of wisdom.
Oh, my words of wisdom are few and far between, Josh. You know that. No, but what I'm going to talk about is an update for a trial that I don't know, Josh, if you've sort of felt this as well, has quite a bit of interesting discourse around it in the past, and that's Keynote 564. Keynote 564 is colloquially known as the adjuvant Pembro trial in renal cell cancer. So we know from multiple studies in the past that there is no evidence up to this point of any form of adjuvant therapy post-nephrectomy for patients with renal cell cancer. They tried it with sunitinib. They tried it with several other novel TKIs. I think they tried it with cabozantinib and maybe pazopanib at some point. No dice. They tried it with nivolumab. No dice. And so it's been a real area of question whether there is anything that we currently have that improves outcomes after nephrectomy, because a significant proportion of patients with renal cell cancer will recur. And so if we can reduce that, that's great. So Keynote 564 had an interim analysis a couple of years ago, and it was not great. Like, there was the primary endpoint was met with improvement of disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.68 and a p-value of 0.01. But at the time, there was no overall survival data. The treatment-related adverse events were higher in the pembrolizumab compared to placebo, obviously, which always makes me laugh when they feel that's a talking point, because you would be very concerned if they weren't higher.
Although sometimes you do see the placebo arm have like 20% toxicity, and you're like, well, we need to talk about reporting of adverse events. That's
or what you're sticking in the placebo. So you've got... We know we have an improved disease-free survival, but the big question is, does this improve overall survival? Pembrolizumab is approved in the States by the FDA, but obviously not used in Australia. So this is the third pre-specified interim analysis of adjuvant pembrolizumab versus placebo. Just going by the study design, and the important thing I will mention is the selection criteria for the renal cell cancers themselves. So patients had to have a nephrectomy less than or equal to 12 weeks prior to randomization, which I think is pretty standard. We'd like to give adjuvant therapy within 12 weeks of surgery.
Michael, do you think that's an arbitrary number? Because we do that with chemo as well. I'm like, where do you find this 8 to 12 week window?
I think it's one of those things that, yes, when you really narrow down on it, it is pretty arbitrary. I don't know that there's ever been a study of 10 weeks versus 14 weeks. And if we're honest, if a patient is at sufficiently high risk for, say, breast cancer, and they have complications, infective complications, post-surgical complications, what have you, a lot of people will still give adjuvant chemotherapy if they're sufficiently high risk and it's outside that window.
And if you know the trial that does show this difference, let us know at inquisitiveonc@gmail.com.
Nice that, plug.
That's
well
inquisitiveonc@gmail.com.
Just in case you don't get it from our outro every single flipping week. But these patients in Keynote 564 had to be of high risk of recurrence. So this isn't just giving it to anyone. Now, what they defined as high risk is a T2 grade 4 or with sarcomatoid features and no nodes involved. So a smaller but biologically very aggressive cancer, a T3, T4 any grade with no nodes, so a bigger cancer, or any T value, so any size of primary tumor, any grade with node positive. Patients with metastatic disease that was able to be resected were included as well. So you've got people who, if we look at their disease, they're at a high risk of having either occult metastases already or having cancer that is liable to come back just biologically. Mm. They had to have an ECOG performance status of 0 to 1, and they also had to have a tissue sample for PD-L1 assessment, which I thought was interesting because outside of lung, Josh, PD-L1... I guess lung and gastroesophageal, but PD-L1 hasn't really been the universal biomarker of success for immunotherapy. It's not used in melanoma. It's not used in DMMR, colorectal cancer.
It's not used, but I think that's the complexities of PD-L1 or PD-L1 staining, is that people respond with low PD-L1s, people respond with high PD-L1s. If you look at the breakdown, I think, of melanoma, though, you do see a changing of the curves depending on their PD-L1 status, and the higher it is, the more immunogenic it is.
Which makes sense, makes logical sense, but how many times have we seen something in this job that makes logical sense and then doesn't turn out to
true? So I agree with what you're saying. We see people respond when we don't know why.
Yeah.
And that's just the check back in 10 years' time when we've done 1,000 episodes and I'm grey and Michael's deaf.
What?
And we might have
oh, God, it's already happening. Yeah, so lots of unknowns here, but it is interesting that they're looking at this. Of note, it should be worth noting that they use combined proportion score, not tumor proportion score, so more akin to the gastric cancer scoring than the lung cancer scoring.
And breast, I'm pretty sure, uses CPS.
And breast, yeah, you're absolutely right. So baseline characteristics, they're relatively well-balanced. It's all the standard stuff. I have highlighted a couple of things here. So the majority of people, about 85% in both groups, had intermediate to high risk. So I don't exactly know how they've divided up between intermediate, high, and high, but they have a lower end of high, I guess is the best way to say it. So only 5% in both groups had metastatic disease, and only 8% in both groups had quote-unquote high risk disease. In terms of sarcomatoid features, because we know if you've got amidst all of the renal cell cancers, sarcomatoid is one of the nastier ones. 10% had present features in both groups. And in terms of the PD-L1 status, it was the CPS score was greater than 1, greater than or equal to 1 in about 3/4 of both groups. So balanced, but it's important to know that we're looking at, within their predefined cohort, we're looking at potentially patients with, quote, lower, relatively speaking, risk disease, with few patients with sarcomatoid features, and most patients had a high PD-1. So you would expect from that they're going to have a good prognosis, a relatively low risk of recurrence at baseline, and theoretically, they're going to respond better with immunotherapy. Will that be the case, though? Well, we know that they've got the DFS, but anyway. So overall survival, still not reached in both groups. They have 55 events in the pembrolizumab group versus 86 events in the placebo group. This is with 500 patients in each group. However, the hazard ratio is now statistically significant. So 0.62 with a p-value of 0.002. So statistically speaking, we have an overall survival benefit, which is brilliant. And I guess the best way to contextualize all of this, because, you know, we're all about contextualization on this show, is to look at the overall survival rates at various time points. And I'll skip the 12 and 24 months because they're relatively close. But the 36-month overall survival rate was 93.9% in the pembro group versus 89.5% in the control group. And the 48th-month overall survival rate was 91.2% in the pembro group and 86% in the placebo group. So, Josh, I'm getting sort of flashbacks to a lot of our breast cancer studies or the rectal cancer studies where the absolute benefit is small, but we are starting to see, the longer this study goes on, we are starting to see a bit of a separation of the curves where the drop in survival or the increase in survival events in the pembro group is demonstrably slower than in the control group.
Yeah, it shows the complexities of immunotherapy, and that the longer there is a subsection of patients who are going to respond probably indefinitely, take into account would they have recurred anyway, unsure. But yeah, you're seeing this divide, which raises some promising adjuvant therapy, then also raises some difficult next line questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in Australia, and we've talked about this before, but Australia still has a once in a lifetime rule with exposure to immunotherapy. We're really hoping that that is something that is going to be erased, I guess, in the near future, because it's becoming less and less tenable as more evidence is coming out. But if you give adjuvant pembro to a patient with renal cell cancer, you'd better be pretty damn sure that they are going to be a long-term responder, or as sure as I guess you can be.
So the ASCO GU, I'm on the Euro Today website, which is actually great for anyone who hasn't looked at it. It does show subsequent lines of therapy. So it looks like 40% of patients that had progressed went on to receive further anti-PD-1 or PD-L1, and then another 90% of those also got sort of VEGF inhibitors. They're saying, I'm assuming that's subsequent therapy, but about 80% received subsequent therapy in the pembro arm and about 81% in the placebo arm. The placebo arm, most people went on to immunotherapy as I hope most would.
Yeah.
Again, depending where the countries are and availability, sort of take that into context. But look, it's interesting, and I'd love to see a PFS2 or sort of longitudinal follow-up of those second-line immunotherapy patients, which I hope they're collecting data on.
Yeah, so that would be something. So in terms of subgroup analyses by overall survival, a couple of things to note here. The benefit appeared, and, you know, with all of the usual caveats with the subgroup analysis of any trial, the benefit appeared to be less present in patients who are older than 65, who are female, who had an ECOG performance status of 1, and had non-metastatic but high-risk disease. A couple of interesting features is that the hazard ratios between those with PD-L1 CPS of less than 1 compared to that of greater than 1 were pretty even, so 0.65 and 0.62 respectively. Also of note is that patients with resected metastatic disease had a hazard ratio for overall survival of 0.51.
Mm.
Now, we are looking at very small numbers here, 11 events out of 57 sort of overall participants. So small numbers, but it is interesting, the diaspora of results here.
It's a good word.
I learned it from you. Safety, there's no real new safety signals. Everything is pretty consistent compared to previous updates on this trial, so I won't go too much into that. So the big takeaway from this, because I know we've been rambling on for slightly longer than we like to, is that there is a definite statistical benefit for adjuvant pembrolizumab in this group of patients. And it is probably going to become more numerically significant, clinically significant, if you like, the longer this study goes. But to recap, a hazard ratio of 0.62, and it was observed across most subgroups. The DFS benefit continued. We didn't go into that, but it was pretty stable, I guess. And there were no significant changes in the safety profile. So, as Josh alluded to before, it raises an interesting question. It's a very good problem to have, but it raises an interesting question is, if you have a high-risk patient, do you give them pembrolizumab up front? And I agree with you, Josh. It depends on access. It depends on the patient in front of you. But I think also it comes down to a bit of a philosophical discussion, and one that we've had on this show before is, are you the sort of person who is going to front load the treatment to try and get the best treatment for your patient up front, and then you let the chips fall where they may? Or are you slightly more pessimistic in nature and keep something in reserve, which, you know, is not a futile treatment. Immunotherapy and RCC is a really good treatment.
That's true.
But do you keep it in reserve just in case, knowing that at least in Australia, there won't be much left if you do give them adjuvant pembrolizumab? And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer for that.
I think there isn't. I think it's individual and patient preferences and clinician preferences, but also age preferences. You know, if someone's young, probably more likely to go adjuvant because they're young and you really want them to live as long as possible.
Mm.
And if this ends up being a 20% difference versus placebo, you know, that's what we do for chemo, right? Colorectal cancer, stage 3, you look at the benefits.
Mm. Yeah, I think the biggest difference, taking your simile or comparison there, is that we can theoretically give chemo again.
True.
We generally don't, but the option is there. I think it becomes much more of a heart-rending decision if you know that this is an option that you give now at the cost of taking it away later.
I also think, though, as this stuff comes off patent, there are going to be trials that look at second-line immunotherapy as things get cheaper. And, you know, it's like what was in the 80s was sort of brand new and unknown. It's sort of like where the precipice, you know, where the tsunami of immunotherapy, you know, where we're riding it as fast as we can and we're falling off multiple times with no known answers like this. But I'll stop talking because that's always a wise choice for me. But Michael, do you want to wrap up the episode?
I think so. It's been fun, though. We hope you've enjoyed this slightly more ramblomatic format, because it's going to keep on coming. Now that we can record in the same room, we're going to, because it's much more fun to us.
And no internet problems.
No internet problems, exactly. No recording problems, or at least we hope, touch wood. So join us next week on Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. We're going to keep the ASCO GU train going. We promise there will only be two episodes on this, and then we'll get back to our standard broadcasting template, I guess. But we will be coming to you next week with two more studies of interest from ASCO GU in 2024.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonc.com, that's inquisitiveonc.com, for links to all of our previous episodes. You'll find links to our social media there as well. If you'd like a particular subject covered on the show, feel free to drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonc or via email at inquisitiveonc@gmail.com. This has been Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a podcast by ADC Productions.